some, like farmers, want President Trump to keep his promise of overturning a key regulation that protects rivers and streams.
My fear with the whole Waters of the U.S. rules is basically all of my land here they have control and say over.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, how an environmental rule to keep water clean became so controversial. And water safety sometimes means removing dams that have outlived their usefulness. Pennsylvania leads the way.
By removing the dam, the fish have access to almost the entire watershed here.
Plus, the eagles, their nest, and a gust of wind that caused an internet sensation. Don't worry, we have some good news. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Pennsylvania environmental regulators approved permits for a controversial pipeline transporting natural gas liquids, paving the way for construction. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips reports.
The Mariner East 2 pipeline project is planned to run more than 300 miles through 17 Pennsylvania counties. All along the route, landowners have fought Sunoco Logistics' plans. Pennsylvania's Department of Environmental Protection issued earth-moving and water-crossing permits late Monday afternoon. Huntington County landowner Elise Gerhardt says it didn't come as a surprise, but she's still upset.
It's not just a piece of paper. It's people's lives. It's entire ecosystems and watersheds and farms. So it means a lot. It's pretty heavy.
Gerhardt is in court battling Sunoco over eminent domain. She says she will also join another lawsuit challenging DEP's permits. Construction on the route could start at any time. A Sunoco spokesman says the project will employ more than 8,000 workers. Susan Phillips, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Clean Air Council, Delaware Riverkeeper Network, and the Mountain Watershed Association already challenged the newly granted permits for the Mariner East 2 pipeline construction. The Environmental Hearing Board denied their request for a temporary stay on the start of the construction while the case is being heard. There's more at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. Concerns about safe drinking water in Pittsburgh and across Pennsylvania have been in the news recently. But President Trump has promised to sink the Obama administration's efforts to update and clarify the Clean Water Act. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant takes a deep dive into the Waters of the U.S. rule.
Matt Durbin grows 2,400 acres of corn, soy, and wheat throughout the Muskingum Valley in eastern Ohio, and it floods a lot.
It just happens that where our home farm's located is the convergence of the water from five Muskingum watershed lakes and two additional dams that are on the river. We get all that water together right here at our farm.
To show me, we drive his pickup truck over an old levee, a man-made strip of land next to the fast-moving Tuscarawas River. Parts of the adjoining wheat field are covered with water.
The big picture of that is that when there's high water someplace, we have it too. So we're dealing with a lot of water, usually.
Durbin has heard of the Waters of the U.S. rule, an update of the Clean Water Act put out by the Environmental Protection Agency. He's not exactly sure what it is, but it worries him.
My fear with the whole Waters of the U.S. rules is basically all of my land here, they have control and say over. So how long is it before they come and tell me, okay, you can't do anything with this land. This is floodway land. You can't spray chemicals, you can't farm it, and then immediately do I own a huge amount of acreage that isn't worth anything? We can't do anything with it.
This is one of the more frustrating rules for me.
That's Gina McCarthy, administrator of the EPA under President Obama, defending the rule on the public radio show On Point.
It's basically a rule that simply says if you're going to destroy a river or stream, make sure that it does not, will not have an impact on downstream rivers and streams that are necessary for drinking water.
McCarthy says the EPA wrote the rule in response to Supreme Court decisions in 2001 and 2006. These rulings actually made it unclear which bodies of water are protected by the Clean Water Act and which are not. In the 2006 High Court ruling, Rapanos v. United States, the justices couldn't agree on a single standard for the federal government to follow. Justice Scalia said only relatively permanent, standing, or continuously flowing bodies of water, such as streams, rivers, and lakes, should be federally protected. Justice Kennedy notably said water bodies with what he called a significant nexus to traditionally protected streams, rivers, and lakes should also be protected. And Justice Breyer called on the EPA to speedily write new regulations. McCarthy says the agency listened.
Because of this uncertainty in these decisions, we went out and we looked at 1,500 peer-reviewed studies. We started out a science advisory board peer review panel that said, okay, how do we get more robust in the science? They did a report for us.
And that led to the new rule. The agency addressed more than a million public comments before releasing the final Waters of the U.S. rule in 2015. But it was never implemented. More than 30 states sued the EPA to stop it, and the courts issued a stay until the legal issues are settled. McCarthy told On Point's Tom Ashbrook that the rule has been misunderstood. For example, for farms, the new regulations are less restrictive.
We actually expanded exemptions for agriculture. And still, on the basis of gut instinct, everybody decided that it was worse than it ever was before.
The oversight, you mean, the regulation.
The fact that we clarified it
and
we're actually going to do it right now became a threat.
Among those threatened, energy companies like Halliburton and Shell, food and beverage giants including Land O'Lakes and Ocean Spray Cranberries, the American Farm Bureau, golf course owners like President Trump, and builders.
My name is Daniel Durden. I'm the chief executive officer for the Pennsylvania Builders Association.
Durden says the Waters of the U.S. rule is an overreach by the government. He says that in clarifying what's regulated, the EPA took authority over nearly every body of water, even intermittent and ephemeral streams.
So ephemeral, as the natural meaning, would be the very fleeting flowing waters that might be in a gully following a heavy rain. So we're talking about areas that would never have been thought to be part of or regulated by the Clean Water Act in the past. Suddenly that low-lying area on your farm or that ditch, naturally occurring ditch on the edge of your development, suddenly may be regulated under the Clean Water Act.
Former EPA Chief Gina McCarthy says the rule focuses on streams, not gullies and ditches, as critics suggest, and that it expanded the reach of the Clean Water Act by only about 3%. The rule has the support of national environmental and fishing groups. Myron Arnowitt is director of the Pennsylvania chapter of Clean Water Action. He says the Water of the U.S. rule would provide important new protections to many streams in the state.
Over half of stream miles in Pennsylvania are protected by the Clean Water Rule that weren't previously. And I think that's really important to preserving our water quality health in Pennsylvania.
President Trump's new EPA Administrator, Scott Pruitt, has promised to withdraw the rule. As Oklahoma Attorney General, he sued the EPA over the rule. Larry Liebesman is a former Justice Department attorney who focuses on the Clean Water Act. He says it won't be that easy to just scrap the rule.
The new administration could not just preemptively just rescind the rule without any basis, in fact, to do so. They'd have to have a reason or a rationale for doing that.
Trump's EPA would have to contend with a 300-page legal and scientific defense of the Waters of the U.S. rule submitted to the Supreme Court during the last week of Obama's presidency. The High Court is currently deciding which lower court should hear the case. Republican lawmakers have also tried to step in to rescind the rule, and a House-approved bill passed last year prohibits the use of any funds to enforce the rule. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
Are environmental groups nervous about President Trump's pick for the Supreme Court? Yep. And it's not even about how Judge Gorsuch has ruled on environmental cases in the past.
They will tell you that what they're very anxious about is his disinclination to get to the merits of the case by simply saying you don't belong in court in the first place.
Later on the Allegheny Front, what a new Supreme Court justice might mean for Obama-era environmental rules like the Clean Power Plan. Stay tuned. Dams and dam safety were front and center this week as 100,000 people were evacuated in California because of structural damage at the country's tallest, the Oroville Dam. Officials were afraid that the compromised spillway there could cause catastrophic flooding after heavy rains. Now, that dam helps provide drinking water and hydroelectric power to millions of Californians. But 75% of Pennsylvania's 3,000 dams are what are called low-head dams. They don't provide drinking water or create reservoirs for floodwaters. I met up with Lisa Hollingsworth-Segedy from American Rivers, a restoration and conservation group, at a low-head dam removal site on the Little Sewickley Creek, north of Pittsburgh.
Okay, so you can see here where we're looking right across. You see this little tree right over here with the top out of it?
She's holding up an enlarged photo of what the now free-flowing creek looked like from right here where we're standing on the creek bed in 2015, just before the dam was removed.
That looks like steps.
It does. It was a concrete structure. This part is called the apron. It's the flat part in the front that sort of breaks the first fall of the water as it comes over the dam. And part of the reason that this dam was so dangerous is that there was actually space between this apron and the water surface when the water was low. And what that means is if somebody got washed over, they could actually go underneath the dam and they could get trapped under there.
Why was it put here in the first place?
It was interesting. I had to go to Harrisburg and do some research at dam safety. The dam was actually built in the 1920s to provide water for a swimming pool.
A private swimming pool?
A private swimming pool.
Their swimming pool is gone now, obviously, and the dam just remained.
That's correct. I talked to some people that lived in this area, and they told me that in the 1950s, people would actually drive their car down on the dam and wash their car in the stream.
Great.
That's kind of what I thought.
You probably wouldn't want to encourage people to do that.
No, we certainly wouldn't.
Now, your organization, American Rivers, tracks dam removals yearly all around the country. And in 2016, Pennsylvania led the nation in dam removals, 10 dams removed last year. And that's the 14th year in a row that Pennsylvania was first in dam removals. Why so many here in Pennsylvania?
We have something unusual in Pennsylvania. It's called a restoration waiver. And what that means is that DEP does some of the legwork for the permitting. We don't have to go to the Corps of Engineers for most projects. And that gives us a very streamlined permitting process that makes dam removal easy. The people in Pennsylvania regulatory agencies that we work with recognized early on that dam removal had some short-term impacts, but that the long-term benefits very much outweighed the short-term impacts. As long as we work surgically and remove those dams carefully and don't let too much sediment go too quickly.
And what are the long-term benefits of dam removal?
Well, I use this stream as an example. The Western Pennsylvania Conservancy had 5 years of surveying data, and they found that there were like 32 species of fish below this dam and only 7 species above the dam. Fish were trying to swim up from the Ohio River. They could only get as far as the dam, and they couldn't get past it. Removing this dam reconnected over 17 miles of habitat. And that's important because fish move upstream to smaller waters to reproduce. So when it's time for them to make new little fish, they're looking for small streams for that. In addition, dams also impact oxygen level in the stream. They actually make it lower. You get sort of a bathtub effect where you get this water that's slow behind the dam. It isn't circulating and it warms up. That causes the oxygen to dissolve. That makes it more attractive for invasive species. And then another reason for removing dams is the community benefits. Now you don't have to worry about children coming down to the creek and playing here and falling, going over the dam, getting trapped underneath and drowning. Low-head dams kind of look like waterfalls or play features or fun things to go over in a boat. But if you get caught in the hydraulic that's below it, it's almost impossible to escape. And I think Pennsylvania leads the nation either as number one or number two in terms of the number of dam-related drownings each year. So if we can remove a dam that isn't serving a useful purpose, we get the ecological benefits, but we also get the community benefits as well.
Can you tell me about some of the dams that were removed around the state in 2016 and what some of the benefits have been?
There were two that I was directly involved with of the 10 on the list. And I'm pleased to say American Rivers is not the only organization that's removing dams. But two dams that I was involved in the removal, one of them was on Pennsylvania State game lands. And it was the first of four dams that's coming out on Dunbar Creek, which is a really popular trout fishing area in Fayette County. With fish, they need certain water flow requirements in order to be able to move. And when you've got a small opening and a large wide dam, it sort of creates like a fire hose effect and makes that water shoot through the dam very quickly.
You know, one of the benefits that American Rivers touts with dam removal projects is economic benefits. And I imagine that trout fishing is one of those benefits.
The state of Pennsylvania makes millions of dollars every year on people coming out. You know, they buy their fishing license, they buy their bait, they buy their lunch, maybe they spend the night. So anything that we can do to connect the community to their river will add to that value.
They're having all of this trouble at the Oroville Dam in California because of all of this rain, unexpected rain that they were getting. Of course, Pennsylvania gets a lot of rain, but we're expected to get wetter in the next decades with climate change, more unpredictable storms, big storms. Mm-hmm. So how can dams and dam removals help mitigate the risks of, you know, flooding over the coming years, of coming decades?
Right. I'll use an example from one of the projects that we completed, the Harmony Junction Dam on Conequenessing Creek. This is just upstream of Zelianople, Pennsylvania. During Hurricane Ivan, there were 45 homes that were flooded. And part of the reason they were flooded is because what's called the backwater effect. It's like sticking a plug in a bathtub, filling it full of water, and then when you get in the bathtub and sit down, the water rises. The same thing happens in nature when you've got a dam. It slows the flow of the water and it can't go on down through the stream. And so what we had at the Harmony Junction Dam was a backwater effect that caused the stream banks to overflow. You know, the fire department and the police department had to go out in boats and actually rescue people during Hurricane Ivan because of the flooding. We removed that dam in 2009, and we've since had two storm events that equaled the flow of Hurricane Ivan. And the stream has gotten out of its banks, but it has not flooded any places. Now, I do have to tell you that the community did go through a buyout program through FEMA. The properties were acquired and the houses were moved out of the way to prevent future flooding. But if you looked at where the water level was post-dam removal, if those homes had stayed in place, then they probably would have been safe during other storms.
Lisa Hollingsworth-Segedy is Associate Director of River Restoration at American Rivers. After our interview, she went down closer to the Pebbly Creek and looked for colorful, smooth river glass from bottles and jars that have been tossed and turned by the water. She makes jewelry with it. There's more on American Rivers' recent dam removals report at our website, AlleghenyFront.org. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. It can be challenging to keep up with the latest environmental news happening around the Trump administration. I mean, it's even hard for us, and that's our job. One of the ways we're trying to remedy this is our new podcast, Trump on Earth, looking at environmental policy under the new administration. In our latest episode, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant and I invited Grant McIntyre, director of the University of Pittsburgh's Environmental Law Clinic, and Dahlia Lithwick, a reporter for Slate magazine, to talk about President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch. How might Gorsuch rule when it comes to environmental cases, like the Clean Power Plan? Here's a piece of our conversation.
I think one of the really, really fascinating ways in which Neil Gorsuch is a very different kind of thinker is that he has absolutely taken a pickaxe to the notion of what's called Chevron deference, the notion that, you know, in a very fundamental way, the courts have generally deferred to agencies and to the fact-finding that agencies make when they create regulations. And Neil Gorsuch, one of the real hallmarks of his jurisprudence has been that he has not only sort of no patience for the Chevron doctrine, no patience for the notion that courts are not fact finders, we're not scientists. It's our responsibility to defer to agencies when they find facts. Gorsuch has no interest in that.
How does this play out with something like the Clean Power Plan or, say, the Waters of the U.S. rule, one of these rules that are expected to come before the court?
So when it comes to a Clean Power Plan, one of the biggest questions in the case is the authority of the agency to regulate in the way that they did under the Clean Air Act. If a judge is more skeptical of that agency authority or the agency interpretation, you could see that they would be more likely to overturn agency thinking if they disagree with it.
And the only other thing I would add is that I think that if Gorsuch's views on Chevron deference really hold at the court, I think that there is at least some reason to believe that plaintiffs, say big businesses or advocacy groups, they're all going to have more say going forward in rulemaking.
You know, we're talking about the Clean Power Plan. Julie mentioned the Waters of the U.S. rule, which is a rule that EPA created to clarify which bodies of water are under federal jurisdiction. These were rules created under the Obama administration when the Trump administration has clearly stated that it wants to overturn these rules. It has no interest in these rules. So how does that work?
For the most part, any significant changes or even deletions of rules would be required to go through a notice and comment rulemaking process. There will be some work that will need to be done by the administration in advance of even challenging some of the pre-existing rules.
I would say there are two interesting things. One is that there has been, you know, in fighting Obama regulations and his EPA regulations, there's been a real interesting shift of the arguments and power to the states. And, you know, states have made incredibly expansive arguments about their authority to bring suit and to challenge. And so there's a strange flip that will now happen where you'll have, instead of, you know, Texas bringing challenges, you're going to see California and Washington State bringing challenges using the exact same analysis that was used against Obama regs, but being brought by blue states. And the other thing I think that is really noteworthy is that one of the things that Gorsuch has been kind of famous for doing is to find that plaintiffs have no standing to challenge regulations. Standing doctrine is one of these incredibly technical, wonky things, but it's just whether you even have a right to be in court. And I think environmental groups that are anxious about Gorsuch, regardless of, you know, how much he defers to agencies, they will tell you that what they're very anxious about is his disinclination to get to the merits of the case by simply saying you don't belong in court in the first place.
But Grant, has that actually been done, sort of the lack of, or the, you know, his disinclination to give standing to environmental groups, has that been to their detriment?
Yeah, the standing doctrine, especially as developed and elaborated by Justice Scalia, really is concerning to environmental groups, as Dahlia said. And I think what's interesting is that Judge Gorsuch has not had the opportunity to weigh in on many environmental issues as a judge in the Tenth Circuit, but he has weighed in on standing. In one case in particular, a group of sportsmen challenged a rule to allow motorcycles into a forest, and he denied them standing on the grounds that revoking that plan would have actually reverted to a plan that he viewed as worse for that group of sportsmen.
Right. I see. So he was actually, by not giving them standing, he assisted their cause.
That was his view.
So that's interesting. In terms of the Chevron deference and what you were talking about, Dahlia, about blue states now coming before the court, could Gorsuch's view on Chevron deference, meaning don't give the agency deference, could that potentially now assist blue states in the way it has assisted others in the past?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly, you know, I think that there is some feeling that it may be a good thing that he is apt to kind of interfere with agencies and apt to, you know, second guess. Maybe that is the sort of silver lining to this nomination, is that he's not going to be fundamentally deferential. And maybe that is a ray of hope. Now, I don't know how much weight one wants to put on that, but certainly the groups that are more ambivalent about him, I think that's what they're hanging their hats on.
Reporter Dahlia Lithwick of Slate Magazine and Grant McIntyre of the University of Pittsburgh's Environmental Law Clinic joined Julie Grant and me for the podcast, Trump on Earth. It's produced with Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. There's much more of this discussion on Neil Gorsuch and a link to subscribe to all of the podcast episodes at trumponearth.org. The podcast is also on iTunes and Stitcher. Bald eagle webcams are all the rage all around the country. This time of year, the productivity of thousands of people drops as they become obsessed with watching the laying and hatching of the eagle's eggs and then the fledging of the cute baby birds. Well, the Pittsburgh region has not one, but two bald eagle cams, and a dramatic turn of events last weekend had many eagle watchers really concerned. A big windstorm blew over the giant hackberry tree where the pair of eagles in Hayes, along the Monongahela River, have nested for several years. There was one recently laid egg in the nest at the time. Jim Bonner, executive director of the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania, was on the scene the next day. His organization monitors the eagles with the Pennsylvania Game Commission and Pix Controller, Inc., which operates the camera.
Well, you could basically see nothing. Where there had been a tree, it wasn't there anymore. We weren't there more than just a few minutes when both birds did come flying over top. They circled around the area where the tree had been and then continued to move up and down the river.
Whew. The adult eagle seemed to be fine, but the egg...
We have to assume that it was broken. The area is rather inaccessible, so there was not a search of the ground at that time. But falling 50 or 60 feet, you'd have to expect an egg to break on impact.
And there was more bad news.
The bird was expected to be laying another egg. Usually they're 2 to 3 days apart. We have to assume she just expelled that somewhere else, whether it was just from a branch or went to the ground.
But Bonner says he fully expects the eagles to stick around and build another nest. The site has all the food, water, and protection they need to thrive. In fact, the Hayes eagles have been seen bringing twigs and branches to a new tree near where the old one fell. It's kind of a work in progress.
Eagles will continue to add and build on their nest for as long as the nests exist. So year after year, they bring in more sticks and they become quite large. Some have gotten up as many as 2,000 pounds.
He says it could take them as little as a couple of weeks to weave a new nest that's suitable for raising young. And some good news for eagle watchers is that the Hayes pair were at it a little bit early this year.
Based on past years, we were still thinking it was about 1 to 2 weeks before we would see the first egg. And if we go back over the past 5 years, previously it was towards the middle of March. So there's still plenty of time for them to have a successful season.
Why so early this year?
I have to ask her.
The other bald eagles being watched on a webcam near Pittsburgh, the Harmer Eagles, haven't laid their first egg yet. Bonner says a windstorm like the one that downed the Hayes Eagles tree is just one of the threats facing these birds.
They are dependent on our water quality and the fish that they feed on and feed their young. And although water quality in western Pennsylvania is vastly improved from where it was 30 years ago, there still are some challenges.
They can also suffer from secondary poisoning from rat killers used on the animals they prey on. Bonner says, sure, it's hard to watch something like the eagle's nest and the egg bite the dust. But the cameras capture just one small example of the cycle of life and death that's unfolding all around us.
And so when we're looking at it, we have to understand that that's nature, that we're best to keep hands off. They've evolved over, tens of thousands of years to know how to take care of their young, how to build a nest, how to take care of these things. And as long as we kind of get out of their way, they'll do well.
I spoke with Jim Bonner at his office at the Audubon Society of Western Pennsylvania. The Hayes camera is still picking up sightings of the eagles there, though they're harder to see. There's a link at our website, alleghenyfront.org. Thanks for listening to this week's show. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapel.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, the Foundation for Pennsylvania Watersheds, the Laurel Foundation, the Catherine Mabus McKenna Foundation, PNC Charitable Trusts, and the Benedum Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of energy and conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration between public radio stations WITF in Harrisburg and WHYY in Philadelphia, covering the Commonwealth's energy economy.